Hello and welcome to In the Booth on Sportsnet 650, your official home of the Vancouver Canucks. I'm Brendan Batchelor, as always, joined by Randeep Janda. And Randeep, the Canucks coming off, fair to say, a disappointing performance, arguably their worst performance of the season thus far, in a home ice loss to the New York Islanders on Thursday night inside Rogers Arena. 5-2 was the final score at the end of the night. And Rick Tocchet didn't mince words when meeting with the media after the game, talking about how the team needed to be better, talking about how he was going to take responsibility for the fact they haven't been playing well enough on home ice, apologizing to the fans for the way they've played inside Rogers Arena to this point in the season. And there are a lot of questions about this team's performance and which way it's trending ahead of a home ice back-to-back this weekend with the Blackhawks on Saturday and the Predators on Sunday.
Yeah, Batch, you know, Thursday night was all about effort and urgency for me when it comes to this Canucks team, and unfortunately on both fronts they were lacking. They got the first goal of the game. Lekkerimäki, great moment. His parents are in the arena. There's pop in the building. Dakota Joshua coming back from, of course, surgery and battling testicular cancer. You know, so many great storylines, but the effort was not there. The continuation of the good vibes, unfortunately, didn't last very long. And you know, that game, I think it's not that the New York Islanders are a great team, and it was not the New Jersey Devils or Edmonton Oilers type of game. It was a team that is, you know, they brought their work boots. The Islanders did, and Vancouver simply did not. And that's why I think you hear the conversation and the points from Rick Tocchet. There's a real disappointment there. You mentioned it. He was apologetic to the fans for the effort or lack thereof. And I thought it was just from start to finish that game, one team was skating, one team had the effort, and fortunately for Vancouver, they were not that team. When you draw one penalty that late in the game, when you have six shots on goal through 40 minutes of ice time, that tells you all you need to know about effort.
Yeah, and when games like this happen, there is obviously a tendency to, I don't know if overreact is a fair way to characterize it, because of course it was a disappointing performance. You never want to see that. You never want to play that way in front of your home fans. But I think there is a tendency to read too much into what clearly was an off night for the hockey club. And they have had a few stinkers here early in the year, but ultimately they've got a winning record. They're in a good position. They're on track to be a playoff team and, you know, likely much better than that in the Pacific Division with the wins or the points that they've amassed early in the season. But, you know, when your team plays like that, it's natural to be concerned. It's natural to be frustrated by it. And we've seen a lot of that in the fan base. And we'll hear a lot of that when we do the mailbag later on in the show and answer questions from the listeners. But until it becomes a trend, I'm not going to sit here and say the sky is falling just yet. Have they had a few performances against pretty good teams on home ice that have been lackluster? I think that is fair to say. But I think there was something different about this game against the Islanders, where you're right, you only generate six shots through two periods. You're outworked all over the ice. This is a Canucks team that isn't very often outworked to the level that they were against the Islanders. So, you know, I'm tempted to sit here and say, okay, let's relax a little bit. Let's take a deep breath. Let's see how the rest of the homestand goes. Let's see if this becomes a trend or not. Because even though they've had some bad losses on home ice and lopsided losses on home ice, this one against the Islanders felt a little bit different. And it felt like one of those games that every team has at a certain point in a season where, for whatever reason, you just don't have it that night and you got to park it and move on and realize what happened and focus on some of those things. And we saw them do that in practice on Friday at UBC ahead of this Saturday back to back. But at the same time, I don't think it's fair to read too much into one singular disappointing effort on home ice.
Sometimes you just have to acknowledge that all the things go wrong on a certain night. And for Vancouver, that happened in that game where, you know, the effort, the urgency wasn't there. The special teams play wasn't there. And credit to the Islanders, I thought they brought the effort. I thought they were very determined to play their style of game, whether it was being physical. There was an element of relentlessness by the Islanders that the Canucks, Didn't get close to matching, and that's not to say they don't. Remember that LA game, they were locked in. Calgary, they were locked in. We've seen numerous games, whether it was the Anaheim game, bad team, sure, but Vancouver, you know, did solid in that game as well. And, you know, even go back to their East Coast road trip, beating Florida and all of that. So it is still a very good story for this team. They're 8-4-3. They're going to be one of the top teams, in my opinion, in the Pacific Division. And we've seen that play out to a certain extent already in the season. But on certain nights, you need a bit of a reminder that nothing is going to come to you easy in this league, that every team is out there to win games, that teams, especially early on in the season, they haven't started their death march, right? Like, the Islanders feel like they can be a playoff team, and there are some people that believe that they will be a playoff team. There's determined players, veteran players on that team that had something to prove. You have to match that. You have to play. I think it wasn't even X's and O's to me in that game batch. I think the urgency and effort were the biggest issues, and the fact that you didn't have that baseline, this is the best league in the world. If you don't bring it, the guys up opposite from you are going to, and they will humble you sometimes.
Yeah, and that's a good lesson to learn ahead of a weekend back-to-back against two teams that on paper you should be beating in the Blackhawks and the Predators. And look, the Islanders were one of those teams too. The Canucks obviously didn't beat them. And now they're in a situation where, you know, they've got the Rangers coming up. You want to salvage a homestand here, a six-game homestand where you've lost two of the first three games. These two games this weekend are going to be very important. And, you know, as much as you can say, oh, you know, the Blackhawks and Predators, they're two of the worst teams in the Western Conference. Do you know what that also makes them? Two of the most desperate teams in the Western
Dangerous.
Conference.
Yep.
Because you're right. You know, it's not at the point where teams are in their death marches yet. These are clubs that are looking at their spot in the standings and saying, if we want to salvage anything from this season, we got to start winning games and we got to start winning them now. So, you know, I know the Canucks won the division last year, went to the second round of the playoffs. And to a certain extent, I'm sure it's hard to manufacture some of that urgency early in the season when you've just come off playing such big games just a few months ago. And look, we've seen the Edmonton Oilers struggle with that same thing with their starts over the last couple of years too. But the fact of the matter is, it's the National Hockey League. You've got to show up. You've got to treat it like it's your job, because guess what? It's your job, and you're paid a lot to play in the best league in the world, and you have to execute at that high level, especially in games against teams that you should be beating on paper.
Well, here's also the other aspect of this, and you mentioned talking, apologizing to fans. At home ice, there's been a few of these efforts where at some point, as a ticket-paying audience, of course, there's an expectation that you have a good game, that you provide entertainment value. And I think in a few games, it just so happens that these bad games have come on home rather than the road. The road, the Vancouver Canucks have been fantastic, 6-1-0. It's just that all the bad losses have come on home ice. So I don't think there's anything there other than you're playing some really good teams on home ice right now. And sometimes, you know, when it rains, it pours in those games. You got to be able to reset in those games. And that's what I liked about this team last year, where game to game they reset. You know, very few times did they lose consecutive games. We saw until late in the season, they didn't lose, you know, three games in a row. This team has pretty much that same tendency to start off the season. But within the game, they were able to reset from period to period, from shift to shift. They were able to stack shifts. They were able to swing momentum. Part of that was also the third line doing their job as the energy line. This season, they haven't been able to do that. That's not saying that they won't, you know, they won't be able to do that. But it's about finding that identity. And sometimes it doesn't happen so quickly. Last year, they came out, you know, throwing haymakers against the Edmonton Oilers. And if that's the expectation, or if that's what we're comparing this against, remember, that doesn't happen. The Canucks' record is good, but their process, they still need to figure out their process and their identity.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring up last year and bring up the third line, because Rick Tocchet made pretty much wholesale changes to his forward lines at practice on Friday. The only line that remained intact was Suter, Miller, and Lekkomäki. So he breaks up the line of Heinen, Bluger, and Sherwood that had been pretty good early in the season, but I think it's fair to say, much like some of the team play of late, had been trending in the wrong direction. So I'll read through these lines, and let's break down each line and maybe Tockett's thinking or our reasoning behind why he might be looking at deploying the lines this way and what we might see from the Canucks Saturday against the Blackhawks in that regard. So he had Suter, Miller, Lekkomäki as the first line. DeBrusk with Pedersen and Kiefer Sherwood. So Sherwood is elevated into the top six, gets a chance to play with DeBrusk and Pedersen. Then he reunites the third line. So Joshua goes back on the wing with Bluger and Garland. And then the fourth line is Heinen, Ratu, and Hoglander. So I think the obvious place to start here is with the third line. And Rick Tockett talked about this after practice as well, that, you know, those guys gave him a lot of solid shifts and were predictable and played a certain way game in and game out last season. And it was a big part of the Canucks' success. So now that he's got Joshua back in the lineup, I don't think it's any surprise that he's gone back to that line in particular relatively quickly.
And Batch, you know what they were really good at last year was when they felt like they were on the ropes and you need to swing momentum in game, Bluger, Garland, and Joshua were just fantastic to bring the momentum back, be aggressive on the forecheck, just change the kind of the energy of the game back in favor of Vancouver. So that's one of the areas this season this team has struggled with, where, as I mentioned, when it rains, it pours. That Edmonton game, the New Jersey game, that's, you know, a couple of minutes span in the second period against the Islanders where, all right, goal against, but you want to stop it there. Which is the line that's coming back and saying, we're going to be aggressive on the forecheck, we're going to be a thorn in your side. This line has shown that they can do that. That was last year. And until Pedersen and JT Miller really get going, Pedersen's made some steps and strides in the right direction, but he's not quite, you know, 10 out of 10 Elias Pedersen. JT Miller, we know, is dealing with something right now, and he's had some good games and he's had some mediocre games. You need that third line. You need somebody that is able to swing the momentum back in your favor when your top guys aren't going. So I think it's a smart move. I think it's something that this team needs right now. And, you know, heading into that game against Chicago, Chicago's got a veteran group. They've got some players like, you know, Tyler Bertuzzi, and you go through the list, Taylor Hall. You got a number of guys that are similar to the Islanders in a certain way. Pat Maroon further down the lineup. They got some stiffness in their game, in addition to the stars like Connor Bedard and Teuvo Teravainen. So you got to make sure that you swing momentum back in your favor. I covered an Edmonton-Chicago game earlier this year. In that game, Chicago was able to basically handle the Edmonton Oilers through their power play, through their 5-on-5 game. So a team like Chicago has it in their DNA to change a game, win a game with skill. You got to make sure that you're able to, you know, get in their face, get in their grill. And I think the third line is a step in the right direction.
And, you know, the Blackhawks are going to be fired up because it's Connor Bedard's first game in Vancouver in the NHL as
money
well
on the board.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely a money on the board game. So let's talk about the DeBrusk, Pedersen, Sherwood line then. Kiefer Sherwood, who has been the biggest pleasant surprise for the Canucks to start this year, gets his chance in the top six, the NHL's hits leader, and, you know, a guy that I think can bring some solid forechecking ability and physical play to create a little bit more room for the skill guys in Pedersen and DeBrusk to go to work, on top of the fact that we've seen that Sherwood has an ability to put the puck in the net himself already this year.
Yeah, I think this is, and something that we talked about a few weeks ago, of who has that ability to maybe move up the lineup. Not saying he'll stay there, but is this a player that can at least have cameo appearances when you're looking for an Energizer, a Sonic the Hedgehog type of player on a line? That's what Kiefer Sherwood is here. He's going to be the battering ram that goes on, you know, the forecheck as the F1 on this shift, on this line, as I see it. DeBrusk is capable of doing that, but I think Sherwood and what he's able to bring on the forecheck, you get him in there, you get him in there first, and then DeBrusk and Pedersen can go in there, win puck battles. And I think Sherwood, a couple of areas, he's shown that skill, but you've got two shooters on this line that can help with that. They can play make. Sherwood's also very good at screening in front of the net. You know, this is a guy that is able to win battles in the blue paint. So to me, I like this move. I don't know if it's going to translate immediately or is it going to take some time, but I think this is the player that this line needs, where he's going to go on the forecheck, he's going to make an impact, and then they're able to build off the cycle. And hopefully, you know, he's able to get some garbage goals as well. We know he can snipe. He's had a couple of pretty goals. But I think with this addition to this line, you want him to go look for rebounds and create screens.
And then the fourth line, I'll just say a word quickly about them because we've got to get to a break so that we can hit the mailbag in the second segment. But Heinen and Hoglander, to me, are two guys that have probably underperformed to this point in the year, and that's why they find themselves on the fourth line. And then I think Atu Ratu, at this point in his career, with the depth this team has, is properly cast as the fourth line center and has played that role pretty well in his time there in the NHL. But, you know, this is, you know, I don't know if I'd say shot across the bow, but a message to guys like Heinen and Hoglander that with this forward group getting healthy, you're going to have to battle for every minute that you get out there on the ice. And with Brock Besser being the only player not healthy with this group right now, those two guys need to up their game, because if Besser's able to come back at some point in the next few weeks, then they are the two guys at the top of the list, potentially. I guess we'll see if they want to send Lekkerimäki back down or not. But, you know, based on how well he's played through the first two games, I think he's going to get at the very least a good look here. So Heinen and Hoglander, to me, that's a message sent to those guys. You've got to be better. You've got to bring more at this point in the year. All right, we're going to step aside and we're going to get to the mailbag when we return. You're listening to In the Booth on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to In the Booth on Sportsnet 650, your official home of the Canucks. Brendan Batchelor and Randeep Janda with you. And as I remind you every week at this time of the show, if you've missed any part of the program, you're in luck because it lives as a podcast too on the Canucks Central podcast feed. You subscribe to that, you get In the Booth every week, you get Canucks Central with Sat and Reach every weekday, and you get every Canucks postgame show with Sat and Bick as well. And I'm sure the guys had an eventful time on the postgame show after the Canucks loss on Thursday at the hands of Bo Horvat and the New York Islanders. And Randeep, as we always do, we put out a call for questions in the wake of that game. And no surprise that with the Canucks losing and losing in disappointing fashion, we received a ton of questions from the listeners. So let's get right into it. The first one comes from our good buddy at JCOG88 on Twitter, who asks, should we panic about the Canucks' home record? Your thoughts?
Panic, no. As we used to mention on Reach Deep way back in the day, the old worryometer, I wouldn't be taking that out. It's not very high on that worryometer. But, Batch, they had 5 regulation losses on home ice all of last year. They have 3 already, and we're not even into 20 games on the season. So is it an area of growing concern? Absolutely. And it's not about losses necessarily. It's not the home record itself. It's in some of those losses, it's very lopsided. That's where, you know, this team was so good at resetting last year. Home ice was a fortress. We haven't seen that resiliency. So I'm not panicking, but it's definitely something you have to note. And one thing I think you have to be really clear about as well, the degree of difficulty has been tougher on home ice. They played some really, really good teams on home ice. The road schedule has been a little softer. So it's not a good thing. It's certainly an issue that they didn't have last year, but panic, too early for panic.
Yeah, if we're pulling out the old school worryometer, I'm going like a 2 out of 10. And okay. I was asked about this when I went on Canucks Talk with Jamie and Drance on Friday. And my answer is, if these kind of losses that you've seen lately on home ice, some of the lopsided games I'm talking about specifically, if those losses were happening in March, then the worryometer is a lot higher for me. But This is still October and November. This is still a team trying to find its identity with a lot of new pieces on the roster, still trying to figure things out. They don't have their starting goaltender in Thatcher Demko right now, and not to take anything away from Kevin Lankinen because he's been good this year, but Thatcher Demko was a Vezina nominee last year. That's a whole different conversation. You know, Elias Pettersson hasn't been at the top of his game yet. JT Miller's been banged up early in the season. So there are lots of reasons to look at this and say there isn't reason to panic or have serious worry yet. But at the same time, it is a somewhat concerning trend that they need to nip in the bud here and need to do so soon, because the more you lose on home ice, the more you struggle. the more that that becomes a pattern that is harder to break, and the more pressure it puts on you to be good on the road if you're not able to win at home. And as you alluded to, they were so good on home ice last season, and they have been good on the road this year. But if you look at the teams they've beat away from home, like the Florida Panthers, they beat in overtime early in the season, but they were missing a couple of their key players due to injury. They beat the LA Kings. I think that was an impressive road game. But other than that, like the fair question is, what serious competition have they played away from home? The answer is not that much. And it's not like there's even that much heavy competition coming up on the road, right? You're going into Ottawa. They'll be a tough team. Boston, you know, they're okay, but they're certainly not the team they once were. Pittsburgh struggling. Buffalo, you know, what are they at this point? And then the end of that trip, Detroit and Minnesota. So Minnesota, with the start to the year they're having, are going to be a tough road team. But let's be perfectly honest, the real difficult road games don't come until the new year, with a very home-friendly schedule in December, too. So it's good that they've taken advantage of how strong their road schedule has been early in the season, but at some point you got to start racking up wins on home ice regardless of who the opponent is.
For sure, and it's got to start in the next game, right? You got Chicago, who you beat on the road, coming to town on Saturday night. Connor Bedard's first game on home ice in Vancouver, his hometown, excuse me. That's a team that, yes, of course, they're not as bad as they were last year, but Chicago is a team that you should beat. And Batch, we were saying the same things about the Islanders, but simply, they got outworked in that game. The Islanders put their work boots on. The Vancouver Canucks did not. Chicago has that same DNA to a certain level where they have veteran players. They have players that you give them a little bit of a peek at a game and they'll snatch it from you. So Vancouver's going to have to bring that effort in the next game, which they didn't have against the Islanders. So there's no easy matchups. The Rangers on Tuesday, that's going to be a tough one. It's one of the elite teams in the NHL. And the Predators, the second of a back-to-back, that one's not going to be easy either. So it's not a good record at home, but you got to take care of what's in front of you. And right now, that's Chicago, and hopefully build some positivity in the building.
And then, of course, the Nashville Predators on Sunday, too. Yep. Those are a pair of games that on paper are winnable. And, you know, through the first three games of the homestand, you're 1-2. So you give yourself a chance to at least be 500 through the six straight games at home if you can win the two games this weekend. And then we'll see what happens in terms of a matchup with the Rangers on Tuesday, as you allude to. Up next, Austin and Langley writes in and asks, if we can't trade for a defenseman, is it possible to steal one, assuming we say no take-backsies? And
the five-finger discount for defenseman. I don't know if it works.
Yeah, maybe we'll have to find out. But, you know, it's an interesting point that Austin brings up, and he's kidding about it, obviously. But as the Canucks have some of these games where they struggle, and, you know, I don't think it's fair to characterize it as a period of struggle or they're on a downward trend yet, because the sample size is too small. It's too early in the year. And if you look back, they've lost just two of their last six games, and they won those three straight games away from home. So concerning a little bit, yes. Not a losing streak, not a downward trend yet necessarily. But as some of these performances start to add up, even if they're not in a row, but over the balance of the season to this point, people are going to ask questions about the roster and about tweaks and about changes that need to be made. And, you know, I remember we did the podcast after the 6-0 New Jersey game, and every question we got was about trading this guy, trading that guy, acquiring this player. What does this hypothetical trade situation look like? So we know that this organization and Jim Rutherford in the past have had an itchy trigger finger when things seem like they need to be shaken up. And, you know, the area that you're going to shake things up or try to add, if you can, is going to be on the blue line. So the way I'm going to interpret Austin's question, rather than stealing a defenseman and using the five-finger discount, as you put it, Randeep, is how quickly do you think management will seek to try and solidify things on the blue line if the Canucks have a few more performances like this?
Well, you know, the key here is going to be the performance, I think, of that second pair of Carson Soucy and Tyler Myers. They haven't looked great to start off the year, even though they've had a couple of good games here and there. You know, with Philip Hronek and Quinn Hughes, you know they're going to be, for the most part, You're going to be able to dominate play, and they're going to have their off games. Quinn Hughes had an off game against the Islanders. There was plays offensively and defensively. You're saying that's not Quinn at his best, and the same goes for Filip Hronek. But more often than not, we've seen their underlying numbers. They're going to dominate play when they're out there. The second pair is the one that I think the Canucks should be a little worried about right now, because through about, you know, just short of 20 games now, the sample size hasn't looked great for Soucy and Myers. They were rock solid last year. They were a shutdown pair in the playoffs, but we're not seeing that consistency. We're not seeing that versatility. And I think one thing to really keep in mind last year, remember during the regular season, Carson Soucy played 40 games. Ian Cole on this roster was huge for the team. He was playing second pair of minutes before the Zadorov trade. He was a guy that could move up and down, right or left. The Canucks are lacking that versatility right now. So I think that second pair may be getting... stabilizing their play is going to be big in this conversation. And if they cannot, yeah, of course the management has to look and say, all right, this balance is not coming from that second pair. How do you add more? Do you move some pieces around? Do you separate Hughes and Hronek? Or do you start looking externally to say, that player you want to pick up around trade deadline where you can accrue about $6 million or thereabouts in cap space, you have to jump on that a little bit early on a defenseman if he is out there. And I know we've talked a lot about defensemen and who could maybe be available. I'm going to throw another name in there because I think this team is already out of the running to a certain extent, or will be very soon. Ivan Provorov of the Columbus Blue Jackets is another name on that left-hand side that is number one on a lot of players to watch, along with Rasmus Anderson. That's another guy. He plays the left-hand side, but you know, there's going to be a number of names that pop up on the list, Batch. And I think a lot of this is going to come down to Soucy and Myers, and can they stabilize? If they can't, then we might be having a discussion about a trade going down.
Yeah, and Marcus Pettersson's name has been brought up this week, too. So that'll be interesting to see if any of those defensemen move, and then what the prices are for those kind of guys as well, because they're going to be highly sought after, not just by the Canucks, but by teams all around the NHL. And you mentioned this briefly, but let's dig into it a little bit more, because Matthew writes in with a question and asks, would splitting Hughes and Hronek benefit Hronek? The pair are crossing at the blue line and Hronek is opening up for one-timers, but Hughes' new shot mentality is leaving Hronek providing very little in the offensive zone. He has a bullet and it's being underutilized. And, you know, this is an interesting point, and I just want to highlight something that we saw not in game against the Islanders, because the Canucks didn't get looks on the power play in that game, or I believe they got one in the third period when the game was already out of hand, if I'm not mistaken. But in the morning skate prior to that game, they had moved Hronek on the second power play unit down to the left flank with his right shot one-timer, and they had Brännström running the top of the point. Now, that's a little bit different from this question, which is talking about 5-on-5 and trying to use Hronek's shot as a weapon. But I think it's clear the coaching staff realizes that that is a weapon that maybe has been underutilized thus far on the power play. And now the question is going to be, are there changes to be made there at 5-on-5 in terms of freeing up Hronek to maybe be the catalyst on a pair and provide a bit of offense? But at the same time, Hughes and Hronek have played so well together and been so solid that you can understand why they might be loath to separate them, with Quinn Hughes dominating the game as much as he has to start the year.
So I was an advocate of having Hughes and Hronek split up in preseason just to see different looks in the games. They play it in separate games, so you got to look at, all right, how do they look with different partners? Now, the reality is they're one of the best defensive pairs in the NHL. They tilt the rink when they're out there. Do you forego that for a little bit more balance further down the lineup? And here's the thing. If you split them up and you say, all right, Hughes plays with Myers or maybe Noah Juulsen if he draws into the lineup because Desharnais is a little banged up, according to Rick Tocchet, you know, that's something that you could do. Tyler Myers and Quinn Hughes hasn't been a lasting pairing. They haven't looked all that impressive when together, and that's one that I would probably stay away from. Noah Juulsen, Quinn Hughes is more of a temporary fix. I don't think it has much staying power, to be quite honest with you. But if you go to the second pair, you know, is that Soucy Hronek? Maybe a little bit of balance there. Soucy can take the back seat. Hronek is a little bit more advanced in moving the puck up the ice. And then you can go, you know, Brännström depending on how you want to go with that pairing on the right-hand side as well. So I think there's a couple of options that you could do. And if Desharnais is back in the lineup, you have a situation where you could split, you know, both of those guys up. You haven't seen it with Quinn Hughes, but, you know, Brännström and Desharnais have been good. So it really depends on what Rick Tocchet and Adam Foote want here. I would still go for Hughes and Hronek as that super duo. But one thing that I'd like to see from this team is maybe separating Soucy and Myers. That's been a constant this year. It hasn't looked great. And even though later on in the year you can go back to it as your shutdown pair, is this an opportunity for maybe a Brännström Myers? That might be a little bit more high event than you want. But if you tell Tyler Myers to take a back seat and let Brännström do a lot of the puck carrying, is that something that at very least you could see Brännström at a few more minutes, a little bit more ice time? And I wouldn't say necessarily more adventurous, but is there another option there as a puck carrier on the second pair?
Yeah, if there was a tweak to be made on the blue line right now, I think that is the tweak that I would be making, is elevating Brännström and demoting Soucy, if you want to call it that, based on the way that their games have been trending. But, you know, we've seen Rick Tocchet quite willing to make tweaks in the forward group, less willing to do so on the back end. And I think ultimately he is banking on Soucy and Myers finding that form that was so good for them last year here at some point. And then, as we've already alluded to, if they don't, is that something that the organization tries to address via trade? Or do we see Brännström get some elevated minutes? That remains to be seen for the moment, because Soucy, you know, as much as you might want to demote him 5-on-5, he's still been a key penalty killer for this team. Last I checked, he was leading them in shorthanded minutes this season. So, you know, there's a balancing act there for sure. And then the right side is another conversation in terms of, if you are moving Hronek down, does it make sense to have Noah Juulsen essentially playing on your top pairing? How many minutes would he actually play with Quinn Hughes in that scenario? You know, with the way the blue line's currently constructed, I don't see a lot of room for a lot of tweaking. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go and get another legitimate top four defenseman on either side, really, someone that can either bump Myers down or bump Soucy down, depending on the situation, or really just round out the depth of your pairings, then, you know, then you can have a conversation about tweaking some of these things. But right now, other than maybe moving Brännström up and demoting Soucy, as you said, I don't see a whole lot of room to make too many changes there right now. Next question from Justin in East Van. Are the Canucks overplaying Kevin Lankinen? And I want to pair this question with another question from Ivy, who writes in and asks, should Artur Shelov's play Saturday against Chicago? So my answer to the one from Justin is, at this point in the season, yes, the Canucks are overplaying Kevin Lankinen. But Thatcher Demko has been practicing more regularly with the team. He was one of only two goaltenders on the ice on Friday because they gave Lankinen a maintenance day. We do expect that Shelov is going to play one of the two games this weekend. To Ivy's question, whether it's the Chicago game or the Nashville game remains to be seen. But you can be overplaying Kevin Lankinen, but if you're somewhat confident that Thatcher Demko is trending towards a return, and with the amount he's been practicing with the team, I don't think that's an unfair way to characterize it at the moment. Not that this return might be imminent, but that it's in the offing here in the next few weeks, then I don't have a problem with you playing Lankinen a ton right now, because he's going to get his rest and he's going to get his breaks, and at the very least going to have a share of the crease if Demko can get back sooner rather than later here and get into game action.
Well, as Jim Benning once told me, Sat, and Dan on an interview, we don't have all the information when it comes to Thatcher Demko and his situation, right? You're right. If Demko is in the conversation of returning at some point here in the short term, it does give you an out with Lankinen, and you can, you know, scale back his game, scale back his minutes. But there is an element of, we don't know Thatcher Demko and how he's going to react and how he's going to play when he does come back. So that's what makes me worry a little bit on the Lankinen front. Yes, he is being overplayed. He's, you know, played a number of games here. He's played very well. Artur Shelov hasn't played in some time now. And we know that Shelovs is going to get one of these games. I would have loved to seen. I know the game turned out a certain way, but if you're able to give Shelovs the Islanders game and one on the weekend, then you give just Lankinen a little bit of rest. And it also comes down to this. If Shelovs is in the NHL, even as your backup, you need to have a little bit of confidence in him, and you need to help him build a little confidence. I know it's a work in progress, but with Shelovs, hopefully nothing of this sort happens. But you know, if there's an injury, if there's a game where you need him to step in, or you need him to start a game or two, you're going to need him at that point. You need that confidence to be built over time. So I think with Lankinen, you know, his game, of course, against Edmonton was not the strongest. It wasn't his fault, but there was a couple of bad goals in that game. We're starting to see maybe a little bit of fatigue in his game, just a tad. He's played great, but I do think it's out of necessity because you've got full confidence in one goaltender right now, not so much in the other. But Batch, if he's in the NHL, if he's a backup, I think you got to get him games at this point just to preserve your actual starter right now in Lankinen.
Yeah, Lankinen's played 12, or started 12, I should say, of 15 games to start the year. So that's a 65-game pace that he's on over the course of a full season. And you look back last year, and UC Saros played more games than any other goaltender in the NHL at 64. So right now, the pace that they're playing Lankinen at is on pace to be more games than any goaltender played in the league last season. And, you know, situationally, it's made a lot of sense. They haven't had a back-to-back yet. Like, this back-to-back coming up this weekend is their first of the season, and the schedule gets, you know, a little bit more congested going forward. So there are spots where they're going to be forced to put Shelovs in, assuming that Demko's not back in the short term, as we talked about. Like, you know, they've got another back-to-back on the 26th and 27th, and then you look in December, and they've got a back-to-back on the 18th and 19th as well, on top of the fact that they're playing almost every other day with the exception of the Christmas break, and there will be more of those scenarios into the new year too. So, you know, the schedule to this point has afforded them the opportunity to overplay Kevin Lankinen without it negatively affecting his game too much. Although I agree, I think what we saw from him in the third period against Edmonton is a bit of fatigue on top of the fact that the team in front of him looked a little bit fatigued too. But you have to find more spots for Shelovs going forward if Demko's not going to be back. And that starts with one of the two games this weekend. And, you know, there are other ways to manage rest, like giving Lankinen the day off practice on Friday, I think makes a lot of sense. Can you find more opportunities to do that? If you want to run him out in more games, I think you can. But at the end of the day, the things that are the most taxing for these goaltenders are the games that they're going to play in. And you can't just have one guy playing all of them, save for the odd one here or there. And, you know, not to mention the fact that it's going to hurt Shelov's development if he doesn't get to play regularly or semi-regularly. And I know they got him down to Abbotsford for one game, but this is still a promising young goaltender in their organization. You can't let him die on the vine by not playing at all while you're running out a guy. And all credit to Kevin Lankinen, and he's been very good, but he's, you know, an older goaltender than Shelov's. We're not talking about him as a prospect. He's only here on a one-year deal. Like, ultimately, the coaching staff's job in the short term is to win games, but you have to think about the longer term development of the goaltenders in your organization as part of this conversation as well.
Well, he's got to get reps, plain and simple, right? This is a guy that in the AHL, remember, he was, you know, playing pretty well, but it wasn't to the same level we saw in the playoffs. He went to another level, but as the playoffs and early this season showed, there's still some development to be done. He's been, you know, tracking the puck was a little difficult last year and this year. And, you know, that's something that needs to be worked on. And it's not to say it's not being worked on, but you also need game reps. You need games in Abbotsford or Vancouver. So the hope is he's able to not only see either Chicago or Nashville, but even beyond, are there situations where if this team can get a few wins, it just makes it a little bit easier to get Shelovs in the crease. Down the road, they're going to be playing the Bruins and the Penguins on a back-to-back in the 26th and the 27th. That's another spot for them. You know, is there potential for a game against Buffalo or the Detroit to end off the next road trip, or maybe even Minnesota? You've got a couple of other options on that road trip where that road trip could see Artur Shelovs play two games, but you have to have a baseline of confidence in him before you make that decision.
All right. Next question comes in on Twitter from Ernest, who asks, why did Tockett take accountability and say he was outcoached by Waugh after the game against the Islanders? Was it something that he didn't address during these poor performances at home? And, you know, I can't get into Rick Tockett's mind as to why he felt that he needed to take accountability. My best guess is that he would say, look, if the team doesn't perform at that level, that's on me because I'm the coach. I have to get them ready to play. And they didn't play to the level that I expect them to in that game. He also talked after practice on Friday about how he's maybe been a little bit, you know, soft is the wrong word, but maybe that he hasn't been hard enough on them early in the year, and that might change here. So, you know, his messaging to the team and the standard that he wants them to hit is something that he's going to be a little bit more strict on going forward. But ultimately, I agree with the underlying sentiment of Ernest's question, which is that there's only so much coaches can do. And at the end of the day, if the players on the ice don't play to the level that you expect them to or don't execute the game plan that you drew out for them, there's nothing you can do to alter that. But ultimately, in the modern NHL and in sports as a whole, head coaches are held accountable for the performances of their team. And I think it was also Rick Tockett's way of taking the heat off of some of his players, too, to come out at the podium and make that statement at the start of the media availability after the game on Thursday, saying, you know, this is on me that the guys didn't play to the level that we expect them to and haven't played to the level that we expect them to on home ice thus far this year.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that was a decision made by Rick Tockett to say, I'm not going to light up my players. I'm going to put it on my shoulders. The other thing is, when a team is not starting on time in multiple games, and even though they scored first in that Islanders game, that chance was really an outlier. That goal was an outlier. It was the Islanders responded with a power play goal and played better for the rest of the period, even though Vancouver had the better start. When you are doing that nine straight games and you allow the first goal in eight straight games, I think the player, or the coach, is looking at himself and saying, hey, the guys might not be ready, but that's my responsibility to make sure that they're ready to go. Even though it's the player's responsibility to take what the coach has given them and download it and do and find a way to motivate themselves. You know, if there's a long enough trend, the coach will take it on their shoulders and say, hey, that's my responsibility to make sure that they download it, they translate it on the ice. So I think Tockett, there's certainly a level of accountability, certainly a level of once or twice you can blame it on the players. At some point, you both shoulder the blame. And I think with Rick Tockett, the other aspect was, and this is something that started to pop up in conversation last year, it felt like Rick Tockett, every move he made, it was the Midas touch. Everything turned to gold. This year, starting off a little different here, and even in-game, the using of timeouts, he's not a big fan of using them. But now, in the Edmonton game, we saw Chris Knobloch, when his team was starting to feel it, Vancouver is coming back in that game, takes a timeout at 3-2, which kind of slows down, allows the Edmonton Oilers, who have some great players on their roster, to take a deep breath, and they're able to stabilize. I think maybe, you know, I can't think for Rick Tockett, but is there an element of, hey, I couldn't stop the bleeding there? You know, that's something that maybe we can keep an eye on as the season goes on with Tockett's strategy of using timeouts. Does it change this year? Last year's team was extremely resilient to start off the year. They were a powerhouse. This year, a little bit more, I don't want to use the word fragile, but they're still trying to find their identity. Does the coach have to lean in a little bit more in-game with some timeouts just to help his guys out and stabilize a little bit?
Yeah, well, the other thing here, too, is, right, we're talking about this within the context of them having just lost to the Islanders. But remember, prior to that, they had given up the first goal in eight straight games and yet come back to win a lot of those games. So, in fact, there is some resiliency to their game because they've found a way to win plenty of games where they've been trailing this year. But
here's the difference, though, right? Here's the difference when you're trailing the good teams. I look at the New Jerseys, the Edmontons, the Islanders, whatever we think of them, they're still going to be a borderline playoff team. Either they're going to be in or they're going to be just barely out based on their trajectory. Yes, the Canucks have shown that they can come back in games, but falling behind to teams or giving up two or three goals against some really good teams, that's tough. That really tests your resiliency.
All right, we got time for one more question here, Randeep. And it comes in from our buddy JD, who listens down under. And he asks, why has PDG not been brought back up from Abbey? Is he not performing, or is he not in the picture? And this is an interesting one, because we don't cover the Abbotsford Canucks on a day-to-day basis. But I went to look at Phil DiGiuseppe's numbers in Abbotsford this year, and he's only played two games, and he hasn't played since October the 29th. So I don't know specifically if there's an injury there or what that situation is, and the track record of the AHL and teams down there in terms of having to report injuries is not quite as strict as the NHL. So there are times where you don't hear as much detail around players when they're hurt in the AHL as you do in the NHL, when a guy like Rick Tocchet is getting asked almost every day about Brock Besser's status and Thatcher Demko's status and so on and so forth. So I assume there's an injury there right now for Phil DiGiuseppe that, you know, is causing him to be out of the lineup down in Abbotsford and is part of the reason why the Canucks have been recalling other players in his place. But it is an interesting point that he in the past has been a Rick Tocchet favorite, and if you wanted some solid play down the lineup, you think he might have been an option. So my assumption is that he's hurt right now, and also that Arshdeep Bains has been good for them early in the year, and whether he's jumped DiGiuseppe in terms of the pecking order of who gets called up or not, you know, we could argue about that. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if this is an injury to Phil DiGiuseppe that has prevented him from even being an option for the NHL club in Vancouver to this point.
Yeah, he did have a tweak a couple of weeks ago that on the same night that Mark Friedman got hurt, DiGiuseppe also tweaked something. But in terms of the call-up, well, with DiGiuseppe, if you call him up, at some point when you call him down, you're going to have to be careful with that, right? He's not waivers exempt. He's a veteran. So I think with DiGiuseppe, is it going to be a spot that, you know, is he going to stay in the NHL for a stretch of the season? With Arshdeep Bains, it's a up, down, up, down. You can kind of do the elevator with him where you're able to use him whenever you need him, and you can send him down and, you know, you save some money, you accrue some cap space. And if you don't call him up, that's fine too. With a veteran who is not waivers exempt, it's always an element of a risk of, hey, do we hang on to him for a little bit? Is there a need, a long-term need on your NHL roster, and is it worth taking the risk? So I think with Phil DiGiuseppe, health obviously is probably the major concern, but you also have to be very sure with some of these veteran players to say, if we need a guy for one game, is that something that you're willing to risk? And Phil DiGiuseppe, at this point in time, he's a wall guy, he's an inside guy. We know offensively he's got his ceiling. He hasn't really been able to produce at the NHL when it comes to offense. And with the added depth in the organization, I also feel like Phil DiGiuseppe's, you know, been knocked down a rung or two just based on the fact that there's been some internal growth with some of the players and some external players coming in. And he's probably a player that maybe later on in the year when you need some assurance of playing a certain hard-nosed style of game, early on in the season coupled with some of the injury discussion that we just had, I don't know if he's the guy at this point in time.
Well, and the fact of the matter is right now the forward group is almost fully healthy. Besser's mm-hmm. the only player out as we speak right now. So, you know, for a lot of these guys, like if they get to full health, it's going to be hard for Arshdeep Bains to get back up and into the NHL lineup too, just because Dakota Joshua's back in now. You know, Besser's going to have to bump somebody out of the lineup right now, and whether that means Lekkerimäki goes back down or whether it means someone like Hoaglander comes out of the lineup, for guys in Abbotsford, that battle to be the first call-up is going to be that much more fierce because there's going to be more guys in that mix and less opportunity to come up and play for the big club if they can get back to full health in terms of their forward group. All right, that does it for our time on the show this week, Randeep. Before we go, I know you'll be on Hockey Night in Canada, Punjabi, on Saturday. What do you guys have on your show this week?
We've got a big national game. It's going to be Toronto versus Edmonton. McDavid, not versus Matthews, but Marner and Nylander have been playing well. And, of course, Connor Bedard returning to his hometown, Vancouver, Chicago, which you'll be covering as well on radio.
Yes, I'll have the call with Landon Ferraro joining me here on Sportsnet 650. 7 o'clock puck drop on Saturday night with the pregame show beginning at 6. But thanks for joining us on this week's edition of In the Booth, and we'll talk to you next week right here on Sportsnet 650.